Many of you may be familiar with the term clicks and bricks, or clicks and mortar. The buzzword denotes the integration of a click of a mouse, the internet, and the web to the physical world of streets, skyscrapers, sidewalks, asphalt, and the people who use these things every day. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, we're giving you part two of our two-part series on the new American city. With billboards in the heart of Kansas City claiming that with Google Fiber we're now faster than New York, we explore the idea of a connected city with, well, someone from Boston. How American is that? Join us for a conversation with Nigel Jacobs, co-chairman of the New Urban Mechanics Office for the mayor of Boston, Massachusetts. The conversation on the future of the American city continues on Central Standard after this hour's NPR News. Good morning, Kansas City. At a recent conference at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts, all kinds of people got together to discuss the new American city, the connected city. And they were connected in conversations about parking spots in L.A. while we sat in Kansas City, looking at these parking spots change in real time on an iPad, held by a man from the Bay Area of California, who stood next to a man who was on the phone to Copenhagen, Denmark. Next to him was a man from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Maybe not a big deal in a global world. But the focus the world over was how to connect right where we physically stood, how to connect in the city, and how that changes our city's connection to us. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. We now begin our second part of a two-part series on the new American city. Joining us now is Nigel Jacob, co-chairman of the mayor's office for the New Urban Mechanics for the city of Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome to Central Standard.
Thanks very much. I'm glad to be here.
Now, you just spoke at the New American City Conference here in Kansas City. What did you talk about?
So I spoke about our approach to civic and urban innovation in Boston, which we call the New Urban Mechanics. We've been running this approach for about 3 years, and it's all about developing new tools, technologies, you know, moments of engagement for the public.
Such as what? What is New Urban Mechanics in a practical sense?
New Urban Mechanics is our R&D lab for creating different kinds of technologies, different kinds of designs, promoting collaboration between the community and government. So we do a lot of mobile technologies. We've developed a few over the last few years. We've developed a series of design interventions about rethinking elements of the streetscape. And we do some very specific collaborative training to teach the skills of participatory design and human-centered design to community groups and local innovators in Boston.
You mentioned an R&D lab. Is this sort of a real-time research and development lab with city stakeholders and city politicians and officials and regular everyday citizens? Is that what you're kind of getting at?
Sure. So the idea here is that we're interested in facilitating real, actual problem-solving collaboration and the development of solutions in a partnership-based way, so that we'll have a community group that is looking to solve some particular problem. We'll have a technology partner that's wanting to help them deliver a technology solution to that. We'll have a government department represented that would be required to, in some cases, to actually deploy that particular service. And they're working together to develop these things. And we're there to grease the skids, to make sure that it actually is working, and to deliver the solution once it's developed.
An example of that is the City Worker app that mm-hmm. was developed under your Urban Mechanics program there mm-hmm. in Boston, Massachusetts. Talk about the City Worker app.
So City Worker is actually an evolution of a few different tracks. So 3 years ago, we developed a mobile app with which we wanted to really redefine the way that the public thinks about government services. And so our interest was in developing a piece of technology that would be fun to use. You know, it would be an engaging experience that would enable the public to partner with government in reporting issues of disrepair at the on the street level, so potholes, graffiti, and so on. So based on the strength of that application, it's been a runaway hit for us. What we began seeing were the city personnel actually using it for their jobs, which was really interesting. We hadn't anticipated that. And what they were using in particular, there's a map function on Citizens Connect that people were using to find the elements that they need to be working on. So we connected with those folks, with the city workers, and asked them, would it be useful to have a version of this app for you that was tailored for your use? And they said, sure. And so since then, we've developed this technology, City Worker. So it's a version of the original app, but targeted at the specifics that the city worker needs to get their work done. So that gives you their task list that they're working on throughout the day, and it gives them the ability to close the issue, you know, whatever it is, whether pothole, what have you, and then to snap a photo and attach it to the closed report.
So basically, city workers in this vein become almost like help desk representatives for the city. You're talking about closing the issue. I'm very familiar with that in the corporate spheres. Mm-hmm. So if there's a pothole, you can use the app to say this issue is closed, as is this pothole, using that platform.
Exactly. So the goal of this technology for us, or one of the goals, is to really personalize government. I think we've spent the last 20 years trying to professionalize government, and that's resulted in efficiencies, but it's also resulted in the general, I think, consensus among people that government is a bureaucracy. So we're really interested in repersonalizing government and sort of finding ways to connect people, you know, your the resident, to the actual person that's going to fix the issue. So now we have this conduit between Citizens Connect and City Worker, and we're going to be playing with that that channel over the next several months around how we can bring those two people together. So, for example, once the pothole repair that you submitted gets closed out by Jim at Public Works, you can actually reopen it if you're not really happy with it. And in this way, the idea is that you can facilitate a dialogue between you, the resident, and Jim, the public worker.
And anybody can do that.
And anybody can do that.
But there's a chain of command that obviously goes up from Jim, the public worker, to the public works department, and that works all through the app.
So the way this works on the back end is that when you request send in use Citizens Connect to request a some kind of service, it goes into the same technology on the back end that the public works folks use to actually dispatch people to fix.
Right.
So it's all being tracked. It's all being, you know, you get a tracking number that you as a resident can use to follow up on the issue. And when it's closed, it's officially closed in the system. But then when you reopen it, it gets reopened and so on.
Let's back up into the larger sphere of the connected city, mm-hmm. the breakout session that you did for the New American City Conference here that was based at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts in Kansas City. What is a connected city? What makes a city connected?
So I think that cities are connected when the people that live in that city are connected. You know, our approach to innovation is really about people. You know, how do you enable people to solve problems and to become entrepreneurs and innovators and so on? So when we think of the connected city, it's really about finding ways to bridge the gaps that we often see across communities. Sometimes that can take the form of discrete, like, geographic neighborhoods, you know, trying to find ways for people to meet each other and to find ways to work with each other. But it also can mean institutional boundaries. You know, every city has resources in the way of universities, hospitals, government, and so on, but they often don't work well together. And when they do, it's often a very transactional way. We're really interested in promoting genuine, sleeves rolled up kind of collaboration across these different organizations. So our approach to doing that is what we call civic innovation, which is really
sort of a platform agnostic approach to different stakeholders in the city.
That's right. That's right. And so we believe that we can there's already innovators throughout society, obviously, within government, outside of government. And we're interested in finding ways to resource those people. Right. So it might be a mother, a parent in a neighborhood that's trying to solve or deal with local rising rates of autism. And that is trying to develop a solution to that. And so we can work with that person to both develop a technology and deploy it, and as well as sort of build an organization around that. So we think there are civic innovators everywhere, that they're really, kind of kind of diamonds in the rough, and then we're really here to sort of support those people, resource them, enable them to develop these solutions.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Our guest is Nigel Jacob. He's the co-chairman of the Mayor's Office of New Urban Mechanics for the city of Boston, Massachusetts. He came to Kansas City recently to discuss the concept of a connected city, renewing urban services and governance, presumably through technology, but also through the integration of clicks and mortar, or bricks and clicks, as you say,
right,
Nigel. Talk about that integration and what makes a city connected and what you've found here in Kansas City.
So I think there's lots of, on the technical side, there's lots that can be done to stitch together the various communities of interest in the city. In this particular example, finding ways to connect the residents to government, I think, is obviously something that everyone is interested in doing a better job at. And so I think that the culture in Kansas City, again, this is my first time here, but what I'm seeing is that there's a tremendous interest both from your everyday citizen, from people that are developing technology startups, from nonprofits and government officials, in finding better ways to work together. And you can certainly imagine lots of technical ways of doing that. But what we've discovered is that when you can pull members of those different constituencies together to develop the solutions collaboratively, that you can establish much deeper connections than simply just a technical relationship. You can establish sort of ongoing partnerships.
Walking around this conference, you discover that there's an app for everything. We were discussing the app for city workers that you developed, and there was even an app for finding parking spaces somewhere, and also a gunshot app that actually tracks audio of gunshots and is able to triangulate that location. How have you reconciled the very real possibility and ethical concerns of surveillance and streamline technology in the home where the government is in your home?
Sure.
Literally.
So we think a lot about this issue of privacy, and we very much see ourselves as stewards of this kind of data. We do our best to not keep data that people don't want us to keep. So in any of the technology that we developed, we make it very clearly that you are opting in to using this technology. So we've developed a technology, for example, called Street Bump, which takes the reporting elements of disorder notion to the next level, where it uses the accelerometers on your phone. So as you're driving around, you and your phone are driving over the streets, and as you're hitting bumps in the road, everything is jiggling, moving. And we're able to capture that movement, those oscillations, and turn that into data that we are then able to analyze to determine, did you hit a pothole, or was that a manhole cover, and so on. So that is, you could imagine very kind of severe privacy concerns around something like that. But we always craft these technologies in such a way that there are you know that you are actively consenting at multiple levels, right? So you're never accidentally running this app on your phone, for example. In an early iteration, we had assumed that the technology for Street Bump, for example, would make most sense if it could run in the background, right? So some phones, this is going back a year or so, at that time, Android phones could run apps in the background. So it means that it was sort of, you didn't have to be actively looking at it. But it also occurred to us that someone could easily forget that they were doing that, and that there was this government app running on their phones in the background, which scared us too. And so we redesigned the app so that if someone wants to use it, they have to click yes, and it's running right there. You can see it. And if you want to do anything else on your phone, you actually have to stop the app.
Indeed, too, in this invisible layer between public and private sector, government and citizen, private contractor and public institution, you also have the other side of that coin. When you empower citizens to develop apps for municipal or government services, what are the plus and minuses there?
So this is an interesting area.
interesting,
think
indeed.
it's very multifaceted. So on the one hand, you develop relationships, right? So you can get local communities actively involved in solving problems, developing technologies, which is great. The challenge is that, by and large, those technologies really aren't product ready. You know, so if a city is looking to just productize one of these technologies, they're typically not at that level. And so some work needs to be done if they want to go down the road of sort of productizing an app that a community group or, say, a bunch of kids has developed. There's always some work there to be done on it. And then the larger question then becomes, how does that technology live on after the community group has lost interest in it, for example? So the sustainability of these technologies is always critical. And so trying to find anchor institutions of one kind that can host the technology or support it moving forward can work. Sometimes maybe the technology is just a one-off, right?
Right, and technology is very malleable, and apps are very hot, and technology is obviously changing with new iterations of versions and software and methodologies and all that. Government is less fluid and has been less fluid and is also based on the whims of people and the unpredictable nature of political and social upheaval or evolution. Sure. So how do you reconcile that thinking from a technological perspective, whereas, oh, it's cool, the speed bump app is hot now, but what happens when I actually need to flag somebody down and how does that work?
Sure. So our way of thinking about, because we are formally a government institution, we think a lot about how do you enable government to innovate, right? And so the way that we look at this, I think often people in government think of as innovation as a particular product or a particular service, right? If we implement this thing, that will make us innovative. But I think that when we look at some of the greatest innovators of our time, you look at Google or you look at Apple, the reason that they're able to innovate and the reason that we love those companies is that they're able to innovate again and again and again, right? And so what we're interested in is finding a way of doing that in government.
Creating a sort of entrepreneurial aspect of innovation in government.
That's right. Trying to create a culture of innovation in government. And I think there's a lot of ways of doing that. The way that we've done this is to begin with the realization that there are innovators kind of in the rough in government at all levels of government that we've seen. But up till now, by and large, these people have not had access to the resources to develop these ideas. And so our approach has been to create a framework, essentially, which is our group. This is what Neuromechanics is, this R&D lab, so that these innovators can step into the lab and we can help them manage the risk that goes along with innovation and help resource them and support them.
So given your example of how government technology interfaces have worked in the past, you know, más o menos, as they say in Spanish, plus or minus, the interface, when you log onto your computer, maybe let's use Parks and Rec, for example, you're trying to find a Parks and Rec location, and you actually want to talk to a person, but the new methodology, the new government procurement process is simply based on automating that process, maybe to save money. Maybe it was a budgetary consideration to put technology where there were once people.
Sure.
And so how do you break that gap? Because now you can't get anybody on the phone.
Right.
You got
the
interface.
Right.
And somebody's looking at it on the back end.
Right.
But you can't get anybody on the phone.
I totally agree. So one of the things that when we looked at government innovation over the last 20 years, there's been this essentially entire focus on efficiency, right, on the business of government, right? You know, I would argue that government is arguably more efficient and more transparent than it's ever been. But at the same time, we also see trust levels in government are flat and declining in many cases. So it's become clear to us that that can't be the only game in town. And when we look at the sources of innovation in other industries, clearly creating products and services where the value proposition is to the public, I think, is the key differentiator. And at the end of the day, I think a lot of people really are concerned about this issue, but how do I connect with people? And this very much is kind of the source of our whole idea of personalizing government. So our approach, and these are really just design issues, right? So you can design technology, obviously, to do whatever you want. But I think in a government context, these technologies work best when they're about connecting to people.
Part of this new American Cities Conference involved a lot of mayors, the mayor of Oakland, the mayor of Chattanooga, similar sized cities, people from Canada, people from Boston, such as yourself. What were you learning in that sphere of influence and in that network in talking to people in the lobbies and attending the breakout sessions? What were you learning about the nature of how cities are evolving worldwide and how this concept of a connected city can be implemented and to the extent that there are also challenges.
Right, right. One of the things that we were definitely seeing is that the level of sophistication of the discussion is increasing by leaps and bounds, and across a wide variety of contexts. So it's not just, you know, wastewater removal. It's economic development and it's health and so on. So it's been really fascinating to watch this evolution in the sophistication of the discussion. Technology certainly is people struggle to figure out what is the role of technology in all of that. But I think, again, people are getting more sophisticated in understanding that any one technology won't be a panacea for everything. But what you can do is improve people's experiences of certain systems or change their experiences and make them more enjoyable. You know, there's a lot of things, there's a lot of experimentation out there on using, for example, games or game mechanics in changing the way that people are able to relate to government services. And so it's been a really interesting trajectory.
How does new urban mechanics address the big elephant in the room when it comes to technology and technology service rollouts in municipal and regional governments, even to the extent that the U.S. federal government is doing its cloud first program or cloud computing government cloud?
Mm-hmm.
How do you address the digital divide?
Sure. So what we've seen, this is another topic that we spend a lot of time looking at, and what we've seen is kind of two observations. The first is that the digital divide has changed over a period of time. So it used to be just about haves and have-nots. But I think what we're increasingly seeing in cities across this country is that we're seeing different levels of technology used just within families. So you'll often see a young person, even in some of the most challenged neighborhoods, we'll see a young person with fairly high-end phones, iPhones and Android phones, and their parents are using kind of old-school kind of feature phones. And so the challenge for us is figuring out different ways of connecting with different populations, right? So again, like this, using technology, we have to sort of not think that it's a one-size-fits-all. We need to find different channels to connect with different groups, right? So if we know that one particular population really focuses on primarily text, for example, they're just sending text messages all the time, then that's how we should look at connecting with those people. If it's a group that instead wants to use sort of high-end mobile phone apps, smart apps, we can create those in that context. And even right down to very old-school approaches, flyers, right? I think that we've done some experimentation around how do you build or create better flyers, you know, better language, better graphics, so that because we've seen some flyers be very positively responded to in different communities and in other cases less so. And so understanding how people are thinking when they see these flyers is another way of thinking of the same problem.
Have you done any targeted demographic studies on technology usage and how it might be used under your programs for new urban mechanics?
So we've done, I wouldn't call it scientific. We've done very anecdotal, unfortunately. That sort of thing is fairly costly. But there's a lot of research going out there. The Pew Center for Internet Research does some great work in understanding how different socioeconomic and demographic groups are using technology. And we're definitely seeing spikes in sort of young people, people of color, that are, for the most part, not using computers in many cases, but are really using their smartphones as their primary way of getting online. And so, and then even further, when you look at people that are using specific apps like Twitter, you know, you see, you know, black youth, African-American youth that are using Twitter much more than others.
Incessantly,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I think those are all incredible opportunities to figure out how do you create tailored approaches to engaging with those different groups.
And you're looking at ways to
absolutely
eliminate barriers of entry in that area?
Absolutely. So there are some great programs out there that we are huge fans of and we try to support. In Boston, there's one called Technology Goes Home, which is all about teaching some of the basic technology literacy skills amongst people that may not have used computers much in their lives. I think there are lots of great programs like that.
We've been talking to Nigel Jacob. He's co-chairman of the Mayor's Office on New Urban Mechanics for the city of Boston, Massachusetts. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we find out more about Nigel Jacob's ascendancy to this position and what his technology background is and government background and how he's fused those together and addressing some of the time-tested municipal issues as well.
Central Standard returns in a moment.
Ain't no love in the heart of town.
And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. We're back with part two of a two-part series, The Connected City, Renewing Urban Services and Governance. Our guest is Nigel Jacob, co-chairman of the Mayor's Office for New Urban Mechanics in the city of Boston. He was in Kansas City for the New American City Conference that took place at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts in downtown Kansas City and looked at the city future, the future of the city as a concept, the wrestling between Jane Jacobs and Robert Moses in different city development philosophies that will be an ongoing discussion as we look at the future of our cities, towns, states, countries, and societies in the world, in the greater world in general, in this connected world. So tell us about the legacy of sort of racial segregation in Boston, which mm-hmm. is what we have here in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. And we talked about the digital divide mm-hmm. and how you bring all the stakeholders together under the mayor administration sure. that you're involved with right now.
Sure. So in Boston, like so many, you know, older cities, we've had this the history of segregation was such that you saw pockets of not just socioeconomic differences, but even underperforming schools and communities that just did not work well. And so through the 60s and 70s, you know, through the civil rights struggle, there were a variety of different efforts in terms of grassroots activism as well as sort of legal changes that required the desegregation of urban school systems. And so Boston, through the 70s, was required to desegregate. And so there was a fairly massive plan to create a busing system for school kids. So what this resulted in, the theory being that if you can connect kids in chronically underperforming schools and neighborhoods to other school options, that you would see, you know, you wouldn't be sort of dooming people to a limited future based on the schools they have had access to. But over what's happened over the last 30, 40 years, I mean, I think it has had the effect of broadening access to schools, but it's also created these a complex system that in understanding, you know, which schools a particular kid is eligible for and, you know, so it's complicated both for the child, for the parent, and so on. And so one of the areas that we do a lot of work on is understanding, can we provide better tools to enable people to understand the system, right? So one could make the argument that why don't we just change the system? And I wholeheartedly agree. And I would say, so right now in Boston, we are going through that process of redesigning the system. But it's tough. It's painful. And so one of the things that we're beginning to understand is that if we can fix some of the user experience, like technology speak, some of the user experience elements of the school system, I think we can have massive changes in how parents and kids are understanding it.
And what are some ways that's happening already?
So one of the things that we're doing is a couple of years ago, we partnered with an organization, a fabulous organization called Code for America, which is essentially like the Peace Corps for geeks, for software people. And so we worked with them to develop a series of tools that were targeted at making the education experience more fun, more engaging, both for the students as well as their parents. And so one of the technologies in particular that we developed was called Discover BPS, Boston Public Schools BPS, in which, again, it's not rocket science, but the idea was that can we take the basic information that is there that had been in other websites and in paper form as well, and simply bake it and kind of construct it into a nicely designed format that parents could understand it and sort of could it made it easier to search and to understand you know, the system more broadly. And it's been, you know, I would say that it was a fairly simple experiment, but it's had, you know, tremendous support or response from the public.
So maybe instead of sending a report card home, you're posting a student's report card and
so I think
monitoring.
Right. So I think that is probably the next generation, the next wave, is to understand how can we unleash all this education data in such a way that parents have direct control over it, and that where it can be mobilized to build better tools to understand more about your child's educational experience and so on.
You're
website says the education strategy is to surround youth from dawn to dusk from birth through college with high quality and integrated educational opportunities.
Yep.
Sounds very interesting and also very Orwellian and creepy at the same time. How do you reconcile that in terms of tracking kids, tracking educational achievement, tracking disparities?
Sure. So the language there is actually referring to a slightly different notion. We have this concept of community learning, right, where you know it's very much this notion that it takes a village to raise a child, but it also takes a village or a community to teach a child. And so the idea is that learning happens both in school and out of school, and that we need to begin to understand that the learning that happens in after-school programs is learning, right? Whether it's sort of sports-related or leadership-related, whatever it is. And we need to find a way to stitch that together. So it's not just your performance in sort of standardized tests, but also these sort of more qualitative notions. And so that's kind of what we mean by dawn to dusk, is really sort of creating a context where all of that is considered learning. So like on the tracking issue, we are not interested necessarily in tracking a student. We are interested in understanding the efficacy of the programs that kid is going to, right? So if they are going to that sports program after school, is that having any kind of in-school performance enhancements, right? Is that making them more confident and so on? So it's less about tracking the student and more about tracking the programs, right? So up till now, in most cities, there really hasn't been a sense of what works and what doesn't as it relates to both in-school and out-of-school time programming. And we're really interested in digging into that. And so, honestly, we don't care so much about we care about every child, but we care less about tracking a child than we do about really understanding, is the particular program actually having any kind of impact?
You're not literally going to be walking around with smartphones tracking them from dusk to dawn, surrounding them literally.
No.
As they're coming home from school.
No.
That's creepy.
It is the fact that the community
is pretty creepy.
Right. The community surrounds them.
Yeah. Right.
And all of that is learning and should be considered learning.
Talk about another interesting phenomenon. We have the concept of clicks and bricks, where you have technologically capable buildings using near-field technology and sensors and things of that nature that sort of allow you to capture data of the living, breathing brick and mortar of a city. Talk about those programs and how you infuse those up in Boston and what you've been talking about here in Kansas City with some of your peers in other cities.
Sure. So we think that there's a tremendous opportunity to kind of meld the online and physical world, right? And looking at how do you create opportunities for the public to really be part of gathering information and kind of being part of the sensible environment of the city. And so this idea of clicks and bricks is really looking at, you know, what are there some experiments that we can roll out, different products that we can develop that can enable that kind of experimentation, that kind of interplay between the public and the public sector, but also across the community as well. And so that can take a lot of different forms. It can take the form of apps that report, you know, issues, which, as I've mentioned, it can also take the form of sort of citizen science, you know, where people are actually becoming kind of like citizen sensors or people gathering information about what's happening in their community. And sometimes not for a particular reason, but because they see value in understanding their community more broadly.
There was a thing called citizen journalism.
Right.
It's kind of
same idea.
Worked out
in some
ways, and in other ways, the democratization allows
a
lot of persiflage
that
you have to wade through. How do you, especially with citizen science,
right?
Some guy comes up with a volcano and says this can work in Roxbury,
right? So I mean, you try to pick and choose,
right?
You try to be judicious in the kind of projects that you engage in the kind of role that people can play in gathering information about it. But you can certainly imagine, like in Boston, for example, we have we have situations where, for example, you'll have a kid that lives in a particular community, lives maybe half a mile from the seashore, but actually has never been to the beach just because of the way things work in that community.
Are they selling seashells by the seashore?
Apparently not.
Maybe.
Apparently, yeah. But what we're interested in is folding those kids into a learning opportunity where they are maybe cataloging seashells right on the seashore with maybe an app or with some other kind of related technology. So I think that citizen science is really about learning and really kind of taking a very different approach to thinking about how the city operates and your role in that.
Talk about your ascendancy into this position of new urban mechanics in the city of Boston. What's your background?
So I moved into Boston about 10 years ago, and I did startups, sort of a technology entrepreneur, technologist type person for about 7 years. And after that, I went back to grad school. And it was in my last year of grad school that I was really interested. I mean, I enjoyed my whole time in startups, but ultimately it's you know, at least at that time, so this was a few years ago, it was mostly about making money, right? And so you kind of get tired of that. At least I did. And so I really wanted to understand what are the opportunities for having some kind of positive social impact.
Was your specialty business itself, or was your specialty an actual software?
Software, yeah. Yep. I'm a software engineer, software architect.
And
yeah.
So how did that develop into the entrepreneurial involvement and then obviously sort of evolving into the
public
sector?
Sure. So I spent a lot of several years, you know, kind of bouncing from startup to startup, kind of, you know, there was just a lot of activity at that time. And so I made a very good network of friends and partners that we were interested in developing these projects together. You know, that eventually kind of ran its course. And when I went back to grad school, I was really looking for what is that social mission that I can take on and really deploy my skills as they had been at that time into addressing some of these social issues. And so around that time, I discovered a fellowship. The city of Boston does a tremendous amount of work via fellowships, and it's a pretty amazing program that they have there. And so I spent a year on fellowship, and I think the obvious thing would have been for me to focus on technology products and sort of like building things. But I took it in a different direction, because one of the things I was seeing is that in many cases, government can be is well positioned to take on very hard problems. And so that can often mean pulling in different partners, you know, whether it's, you know, a school like MIT or Harvard or community groups. And so that's how I actually spent most of my time is building these collaborative partnerships to develop these kinds of solutions. And so about a year, 2 years ago, the mayor, Mayor Menino.
Who you work for.
Who I work for.
Boston's mayor.
My boss. Yeah. Who's fabulous. He's a 5-term mayor, and he has talked a lot about innovation.
So in other words, a dictator. 5 terms.
I think mayor for life is a nicer
mayor for
way
life.
Of saying it. yes, but he's a very well loved mayor and
very popular.
Yeah, very popular. Very very strong in the city, and he thinks a lot about innovation from the perspective of how do we deliver value to people, right? So which is a really interesting point of distinction, right? So it's not about the business of government; it's about what is the value add to the public, and so. His perspective has always been, how do we create a capacity in government to do more of that? Not to just kind of come up with these little one-offs, but like Google or Apple, how do we create a sustainable approach that is turning out a series of products and approaches to connect with people?
We'll get to Google in a minute. But first, you come from a private sector background.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a groundswell of venture capital outfits that are focusing on socially conscious technology projects or technology projects that make government more efficient to sort of tap that market mm-hmm. of public-private sector partnerships with apps or software development
right.
or cool gadgets
right,
or,
right.
or whatever it may be.
Right.
Is there a groundswell of that?
There is beginning to be this groundswell. The space that we work in is often referred to as civic technology. So it's like this crossover between government and the public. And there's a lot of activity there, a lot of energy. And we are seeing a lot of different players. There's really this ecosystem. So we're seeing great foundations. The Kauffman Foundation does fabulous stuff. The Knight Foundation, the MacArthur Foundation, the Bloomberg Foundation. We're seeing a lot of kind of private equity, kind of venture capital firms also diving in. Because it's early days, I think, you know, the business models are still a little bit unclear, but there's still, you know, a lot of different startups that have been able to make this a business and are helping to reinvent the space.
Well, this is when you get in from a venture capital standpoint or private
right,
equity
exactly.
standpoint
the,
or early
right,
you
in
get
early
in when,
days.
Get in when nobody understands it.
exactly So these groups like Code for America, for example, have recently started up a an accelerator, right, which is specifically about bringing in, you know, just like any other accelerator, but focused on the civic innovation space, where the idea is to help these early stage companies kind of jumpstart their activity and to grow in terms of capacity and getting customers.
Let's talk about the concept of Code for America, essentially writing the code of productivity for America. That's sort of their mission in a nutshell.
Yeah.
Is that happening across the board in the tech community, where maybe guys have gotten maybe the monetary and maybe even satisfactory rewards from their own work, and now they want to give back?
Yeah, there's a strong thread there. I think we're seeing two groups, maybe three.
Zuckerberg and Newark is a perfect example.
Right, exactly. So that is definitely one of the groups. But we are seeing people that have spent some time in the technology world, in the technology industry, that are interested in giving back or have, in a slightly different way of thinking, that think that the same revolution that happened in all these other industries can be brought to these civic issues, like to education, for example. There's another group of up-and-coming technologists and entrepreneurs and designers that are coming at this straight as the first point in their careers, right, where they aren't going directly to Facebook or whatever, but they're coming first to these civic startups, or to Code for America, for example, and to be able to take on these problems. And then we're definitely seeing a lot of kind of more established companies like Connected Bits that have seen the value in focusing on these topics, and that have retooled much of their product line to focus on this area. So we're definitely seeing a lot of activity.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. We're talking about civic technology in the connected city, renewing urban services and governance, with our guest, Nigel Jacob, co-chairman of the Mayor's Office for New Urban Mechanics for the city of Boston, Massachusetts. He's here in Kansas City for the New American Cities Conference that takes place at the Kauffman Performing Arts Center here in the Crossroads in Kansas City, the heart of Kansas City, to be exact. So what have you learned at this conference about what everybody's saying? Is there a common thread in the evolution of cities? Each city has its own characteristics, its own history, its own drawbacks, its own charm. But is there a common thread about what needs to happen for the American city?
That's a good question. And if I knew the answer, I don't know if I'd be a rich person, but I would be able to answer a lot of problems. I certainly think that there are several patterns that we're seeing. I think I would definitely say that we're seeing a lot of innovation across the board coming out of mid-sized cities, you know, cities that are in somewhere from 250,000 to maybe a million people, right? And where there's, you know, different groups, institutions come together to take on old problems. You know, some of the larger cities are so large in many cases that things that work there often don't translate well. You know, you think of New York or LA, it's often hard to translate those things to Boston or Kansas City. But ideas and solutions that work well in some of these other cities are more easily translatable. And I think that we're seeing a greater effort on trying to collaborate and not simply to compete. I think there's been a lot of focus over the last, you know, decade or so about competing for talent. And obviously that probably won't go away. But I think there's also a tremendous amount of direct collaboration and learning from each other that I'm seeing at this conference, for example, where mayors are very, very much trying to learn from each other about how they've taken on some of their traditional problems and really talking openly about how do we do that here. And I think it's a pretty powerful place to be.
How does the connected city leverage its own intellectual capital
to
keep
I think that is at
the great minds here. Kansas City has a big issue with that. How does that happen?
So I think there are a lot of different ways, honestly, and it really does depend on what is working in your city. It could be, you know, maybe there's a need for certain kinds of density, right? So one of the approaches that we've taken in Boston is to create an economic development approach called the Innovation District, which is kind of non-traditional in the cluster world. But the idea is not so much to provide any kind of tax incentives, but is really to create a context for companies to come together, because there are inherent benefits to density, just being close together. you find people running into each other, starting up new ventures, and there's a lot of power there. And so that's something that, you know, it was the mayor's idea, and I think it's a brilliant idea that all we really need to do in our context, because we had all these students and we had all these people that were leaving, you know, mid-size or larger size companies that were looking to do new things, and all they really need to do is to be in the same room or in the same place together. And so having them in the Innovation District has been incredibly powerful.
Not just Route 128, but...
Right.
Philosophically.
Philosophically, absolutely. So the Innovation District is actually in the South Boston waterfront.
Physically. In the South
Boston waterfront. But having people, kind of making it easier for people to bump into each other and to spend time with each other, does increase the rate of new venture development and IP development and all the sort of standard measures of cluster development. And further, we didn't choose a particular cluster in our case. We knew that there was lots of people from lots of different backgrounds, and so we didn't choose one. You know, we didn't make it a health cluster. It is literally the Innovation District writ large.
Is it part of the new urban mechanics department or division or the office under the mayor there of Boston to create that sort of revolving door, at least from the standpoint of ideas?
So our approach, yes, basically, our role is to enable people to develop new programs, products, or services in collaboration with government, right? So that's what makes us different than a social innovation or a social entrepreneur incubator, right?
It's not a sweepstakes for a government contract for specifically hot technology.
Right. Not necessarily.
It can be.
Right. It can be. So since on the front end, you know, we don't play favorites in terms of business model, right? So you could be a for-profit, you could be a nonprofit, you could be a private individual. We'll work with you to help you develop your proof of concept. And then if it's successful, we'll help you scale that. And it really depends on your structure, you know, in terms of like what scaling means. In some cases, if you're a for-profit company or nonprofit, scaling could mean the city becomes the customer to that new service or product. That doesn't happen in all cases, but it happens in many cases. And our role in that case becomes one of facilitation and sort of helping both sides, you know, through the contract negotiation and sort of navigating the procurement issues and so on.
What have you learned? It's your first time here in Kansas City, but mm-hmm. what have you learned just from looking around at the physical location mm-hmm. and sort of breakdown of Kansas City, the city proper?
Mm-hmm.
What have you learned?
So I spent a lot of time kind of right downtown, and I have definitely seen a lot of energy, right? A lot of energy. So last night there was this kind of crazy mix of foundation people and government people and startup people, and they all knew each other. It was pretty fabulous, actually. And I've only seen that in a few places, to be honest. I see that in Boston. I see it in San Francisco. In Austin, you see it. But there's like just a handful of places. And so I think that's a pretty incredible platform to do some interesting work around in terms of promoting new businesses, for-profit, non-profit, you know, and sort of reinventing new industries here.
A lot of people say this is a small town with big city aspirations mm-hmm. or major metropolitan area aspirations, but you know everybody who's everybody in that circle there. Is that a good starting point?
I think.
Have you seen a good starting point?
I've seen a great starting point. I think this work really starts best with relationships, right? And that's often hard to do when you come from very different industries. And what I saw was pretty incredible. You know, everyone seemed to know everybody. It was pretty amazing. And I think it's a very unique resource, a very unique asset. And again, not having been here a lot, I think there's a lot further that can be done with that in exploring whole new areas. And a lot of that is really about trust, right? So that if you now were in this environment where for-profit, non-profit, public sector are able to work together in a very trustful environment, it means that you can take on pretty hard problems where traditionally there are these sort of roadblocks in terms of, like, I don't know what your motivations are. But in this case, I think there's tremendous opportunity.
We're sitting here with Nigel Jacob, who's the co-chairman of the Mayor's Office for New Urban Mechanics in the city of Boston. He's here on Central Standard explaining the dynamics of the integration with technology and city services, which was the subject of the Connected City, a workshop that he was involved in, renewing urban services and governance. What would be your advice for Kansas City based on what you've seen and the conversations you've had with local and regional stakeholders in your time here in Kansas City? What would be your advice?
So there's a lot of different things that you can do. So certainly, insofar as government is part of any of that, it's important to create a group or a person in government that is going to be able to facilitate those kinds of partnerships, right? Insofar as government is a part of those things. That's just not – that is often not a role that government plays in many places. And so having someone that thinks about that all the time I think is critical. The city is actually doing that, right? They're hiring a chief innovation officer. So I think that they're, you know, they're well-positioned to be able to do that kind of stuff. Finding very specific ways in which the different sectors can come together around projects, I think, is critical, right? So that could be in some places you've seen the rise of hackathons. I assume that there are some here, or there may not be, but they're essentially short sprints of time, short spans of time, when different groups of people, community folks, foundation folks, government folks, and software developers, for example, can come together, take on very specific challenges,
like Pwn2Own up in Denver, Pwn2Own up in Vancouver.
Yeah, exactly. Rather. Right. And where you can get people, and that builds very specific skills, right, and very specific shared language. I think that that's important for facilitating this community. And also, I would say, you know, take on the hard problems,
right?
And so there's been a tendency over the last little while in civic technology to take on problems that we know how to take on,
right?
And to build apps to do that.
Right.
I think we're maxing out with that approach, and we need to find ways to take on the hard problems.
Be specific about those easy problems.
So we've seen a lot of transportation apps, and they're fabulous. Don't get me wrong. I use them all the time. We've seen a lot of apps, like the one I was talking to you about, Citizens Connect, which is about sort of reporting requests for service. But those are very transactional kinds of systems. And they're certainly worth developing, and I think there's still a strong future for that stuff. But that's like a subset of really, when you think of, you know, society and sort of the civic challenges that we face. There's education, there's healthcare, there's sustainability, all these things. And I think that there are technology-related ways that we can gain leverage on those problems. But we need to do that mindfully, right, and not assume that they're too hard to take on, but really come together as a community and say, how do we actually do that? Are there different ways of approaching this problem using different kind of innovative techniques?
Our guest is Nigel Jacob, co-chairman of the Mayor's Office for New Urban Mechanics for the city of Boston, Massachusetts, as if you needed a state reference for Boston. But he's here in Kansas City for the New American City Conference, and his breakout section was The Connected City, Renewing Urban Services and Governance. Mr. Jacob, thank you for coming to Central Standard.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
You'll find podcasts, archive shows, and more on kcur.org. Our producer is Matthew Long Middleton. Up to Date is next. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard.